This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. Juliet McCannell is Professor Emerita of Comparative Literature at UC Irvine, where she's taught in the Critical Theory Program and headed the research program on women and the image. Her books are Figuring Lacan, The Regime of the Brother, and The Hysterics Guide to the Future Female Subject. She's also edited and co-authored a number of other books, including two in the Irvine Critical Theory series, Thinking Bodies, and The Other Perspective in Gender and Culture. Recent publications include Stage Left, an article on Ernesto Laclau, Judith Butler, and Slavoj Žižek for Umbra, Politics in the Age of Sex, Clinton, Leadership, Love, for Cultural Critique, and Las Vegas, the Post-Cinematic City, for performance research. Essays on Rousseau, Law, Alain Badiou, The Future of the University, and The Two Cape Fears are in press, and most recently she's been visiting professor of rhetoric at UC Berkeley and French and Italian at Stanford, visiting scholar at the Lacan School, and visiting professor of psychoanalysis at the Center for Psychological Studies in Berkeley. And Patricia Garavici from the Philadelphia Lacan Study Group and Seminar, and a practicing Lacanian analyst, is going to introduce Juliet tonight. Following the talk, I have two books by Sophie Call and on Sophie Call that you can thumb through. And if you haven't received an email announcement from us, you can do so at the site theorizing.org. And theorizing.org Lacan is the Philadelphia Study Group and Seminar. So.
Thank you, Aaron. I have really great pleasure today to be able to introduce Juliet Flower McCannell, the author of Figuring Lacan, The Regime of the Brother, The Hysterics Guide to the Future Female Subject. Besides these books, she has edited co-author four other books. She's a distinguished thinker who has worked on subjects that range from Rousseau to racism, from comparative literature literary theory to post-colonial theory, bias, violence, the psychoanalytic structure of love, perversion. Introducing Juliet Flower McCannell is particularly an honor for me because she's one of the most innovative thinkers in cultural and critical theory, especially in something that has been described by James Millar as the new Lacanian psychoanalytic studies. This is a Lacanian psychoanalytic critique of culture that mostly emphasizes Lacan's latest notions of drive, jouissance, and the real. McCannell is not simply interested in literature alone, but in its articulation to elements of popular culture, politics, and art, and she construes a universe that is ironic, tragic, or perversely paradoxical. McCannell has studied the structure of ethics in contemporary arts, critical theory, and politics. She generates a vision of life that one may identify with a paradoxical, perhaps perverse, the bend that Lacan gives to ethics and tragedy. Let us recall that Lacan stated that tragedy is the forefront of our experience as analysts. Lacan discussed the exemplary role of tragedy in a rigorous study that you may know in the seminar on ethics. And he stated that the aim of analysis, as he saw it, was to bring the analyzer to confront the question of human existence as it is posed, what am I there, in that space of law and varied jouissance that he called the beggar. Thus, the analyzer mimics the tragic hero to the extent that he passes beyond the anxiety characteristic of the ego functions to the level of certain primordial horror governed by the mysteries of procreation and death. Like tragedy, analysis points to an ethical field beyond the self-interested pursuit of pleasure, beyond any concern for utility or consequent focus on instrumentality, beyond even the desire for some localizable object, to an ethical field, in short, beyond all utilitarianisms. Being myself a practicing analyst, I find Juliet Flower McCannell's work very influential. In her book, The Regime of the Brother, McCannell talks of a post-Oedipal family. This is a family already anticipated by Lacan in his 1938 article on the family that he contributed for the Encyclopédie Française. This is a family in which the paternal imago, and thus its function, was already then on decline. McConnell follows the family after patriarchy and replaces the tradition of family, father, mother, and child, and follows the dyad of brother and sister. This direction of thought has recently revisited by Juliette Mitchell in her 2000 book, Mad Men and Medusas, arguing that the critical failure of psychoanalysis was to obscure and ignore siblings and peers. The Oedipus complex, writes Mitchell, which, if it is unresolved, lies at the root of hysteria, stresses relationships between children and parents at the expense of those which I think are at the heart of hysteria, the lateral relationships of siblings and peers. So somehow this quote anticipates another book of Julia Flower McConnell, which I will refer to soon. In what McConnell calls the primal sin of modernity, the brother discovers his castration in the sister, and then both suppresses his sister's specific desire for equal access to identity and seizes power by relegating her to a general brotherhood that, because he is the sole real basis of his identity, demotes her to no special place. In the role of the pseudo-Oedipal father, the brother becomes another tyrant, and in effacing the sister, he repeats the patriarchy's effacement of the mother. McConnell suggests that it's far less the father than the brother whom modern literature calls to account, less the mother than the sister who must be recognized and given her due as the real rather than the imaginary other necessary to found male identity and group life. But expanding her exploration on the logic of feminine sexuality, McConnell arrives to a hysteric guide to the future of the female subject. She is proposing there an ethics of the feminine through an examination of women's writing. How can a girl become a woman, this is an ethical woman, without being either a victim or a manipulator? Reflecting on this question, Julia Flower McConnell takes us for the first time beyond the flow models of how to become a woman. These are the models of Freud and Saad. And she examines the quote-unquote perfect coupling of the often hysterical feminine with the usually perverse masculine subject, confrontations that represent crucial scenes in the constitutions of female sexuality. Her studies take us into the Sadian ethics and the prescription of Freudian psychoanalysis, post-enlightenment colonialism, racism during and after World War I, genocidal fascism in World War II, and the slowing of time and generation during the Cold War. McConnell also treats in this book contemporary art, fiction, and theory, considering works by Arendt, Angelou, Rousseau, Kant, Stendhal, Claes, Hitchcock, Atwood, Klein, Chodorov, Adorno, and Duras. Ultimately, this book reasserts, quote, becoming woman as an issue that, until now, has been denied for want of a feminine ethic relevant to contemporary life. This is an audacious, ambitious, and appealing book that fulfills the role of a hysteric regarding knowledge. It creates want, it puts desire into motion, it ushers speech, and of course, leaves us wanting more. Freud said that hysteria is a caricature of a work of art. McConnell is going to talk today about Sophie Kahl, an artist that is not easily classifiable. Kahl's work, we may say, is especially provocative and, like hysteric symptoms, is speaking real. Kahl, for instance, is an artist who is a photographer who only occasionally takes her own photographs. Is an artist who transforms her life in a work of art using other people and becomes herself a character of a novel. Mingling fiction with reality, she not only became Maria in Paul Auster's novel Leviathan, but since Paul Auster took her as a subject, she imagined swapping roles and taking him as the author of her actions. Sophie Kahl asked him to invent a fictive character which she would attempt to resemble. Paul Auster objected to Kahl's request. It was too much of a big responsibility. And because the offer of Sophie Kahl was to do what he wanted with her, and sent her instead personal instructions for SE on how to improve life in New York City. The result of this project is well known and is entitled Gotham Handbook. Kahl follows, speaks into, and outrightly spies on the lives of people she barely knows, with results that both illustrate human vulnerability and tend not infrequently to pathos. Kahl excels in the cataloging of both human contact and distance, and she's using both the medium of language and photography, transposing them. For instance, in her celebrated 1980 work, Suite Vénitienne, Cal followed a stranger who boarded the train in Paris. Both ended up in Venice, and Cal continued clicking the photo documentation of the relationship that developed. Other work has involved hidden cameras in public places and invitations to the artist's room of a parade of friends and strangers who were asked to live and sleep there with Cal taking pictures and notes. Perverse, sublime. McConnell's turns to art and to Lacan's argument about sublimation and perversion to draw the possibility of formulating in the form of a question, a principle of morality beyond the reality principle. McConnell argues about the necessity for both art, sublimation, and sexual difference in the construction of a new model of feminine desire. McConnell is someone with profound knowledge and original thought who is open in a new era of research into the feminine. If someone can raise a presentation to the status of Das Ding, this person, Juliet Flower McConnell. Let's welcome her.
I must thank you for that introduction. It's the nicest one I've ever had, and I mean that seriously. Well, Patricia has given you some of Sophie Kahl, but before we plunge into the canals of Venice with Sophie Kahl, the whimsical Sophie Kahl, let me hint at the serious stakes of this endeavor, my stakes of my game here. And, you know, as you could see from what Patricia said, my work has been very serious. There's a very serious tone to it. I'm always addressing things like perversion and fascism and, you know, something about Sophie Kahl has really taken my heart. And in fact, I have never, can you hear me all right? Is that okay? I would say that I love psychoanalysis. I use psychoanalysis, but I have never fully transferred my allegiance from art to psychoanalysis. Art is my first love, and I still hold on to it. A few analysts may understand why. And yet, you know, you should remember that Freud himself, at one point, even though art puzzled him a great deal, suggested that analysts should follow artists because the artists were out ahead, is the way he put it. And what better artist to follow than the woman who made following her hallmark, Sophie Kahl. Now, if Freud suggested that analysts follow artists, Lacan trumped Freud in a way. And his Freud's inaugural but peevish question, what does a woman want, by demanding that our analysts also pursue woman. If you think of encore, I don't know how many of you, you know, woman is the way to look beyond where we are. Women were to be, a woman was to be pursued, he told us, beyond their phallocentric and pleasure principled limits. And who better to pursue in this line than Sophie Kahl, who, as you may know or you will hear in the course of this paper, has severely tested the phallocentric version of what a woman is. But again, how serious could such pursuits be? I mean, after all, what what do we equate in our modern life with unseriousness any more than we equate art and woman, right? Aren't they the quintessential sort of superfluous, marginal to big, you know, major mainstream concerns? I mean, after all, Freud and Lacan confronted the discontents in civilization, religion, science, etc. You know, what is this, you know, what is beauty, what does aesthetics and women have to do with those serious problems? I mean, somebody like me, yes, I'm a woman, but, you know, sometimes when I write, I get these reviews back saying, you know, a blind review, and it'll say something like, he did this and he did that, and I think, well, that's just the author, the reader saying, well, you know, the generic he, and then they'll stop and say, I am assuming this is a man, right? So it's very funny to me, but it seems to me, what, you know, to ask the question, what can art and woman bring to the table seriously about the modern and the postmodern condition? What do they have to say to this? And as you know, as Patricia very nicely has told you, I focused on the sadistic, the obscene. And a lot of what I've done is focused on grasping the dimensions of the superegoic and its impact on our lives. The way the superegoic, the fantasy of how the superego works upon the subject, and the way that gets reflected and projected into the sociocultural world, our lived environment, our space. And let me just say that this is where I'm interested in Sophie Kahl, and in an art that does really, it's to me the opponent of art in some way, or art's what it focuses against is against the superegoic. And I'll explain in a minute. You know, Lacan in Seminar 3 says that, people don't notice this very much, but he does say that the superego really is kind of an excrescence of the paranoid ego. It's the, you know, it's that evil twin that comes to master you. And yielding to that superego in a way is a measure of your own failure of courage, I would say. Now, in my work, as I think Patricia, I was just not expecting someone to lay out so much of what I've done. Most usually a comparatist will go around and people only know one side of what they do, and that's all. But I have never done what a lot of feminists have done, which is to say, to reject the paternal function, the symbolic, and to say, well, we can do without that. I mean, you know, I translated the work of Hélène Cixous, and I've read Cixous and Clément. I like Cixous' writing, but, you know, as a fiction writer and a playwright in particular. But when they get to those witches and the unleashing of jouissance, I don't think that that's where to go. I've never been happy with Iri Garay's argumentations about, I want a piece of the symbolic too. It's not quite like that for me. And Kristeva, it's too theoretical, too much of a masculine viewpoint. What I have been interested in, though, is the question of whether what we think of as the phallocentric symbolic, should we call it that, the idea of centering on the phallus, or what we think of as the phallus, I've been interested in whether the phallocentric remains a viable mode of representing the symbolic. Okay? The symbolic is necessary. It is the thing that relieves us of the weight of our paranoid egocentrism. It's what, it is what demands that we learn coexistence, that we must coexist with each other. But at the same time, the dimensions, the way that we have traditionally represented the need for the symbolic have not necessarily been, or have usually been sort of framed phallically, shall we say. Now the question is there some other way of representing it, especially in a world where that seems to have broken down? Okay. Now, I'm working on a book on cities, so to me the laboratory for this has been the question of the city. And that's where Sophie Kahl comes in, okay? I would call Sophie Kahl's art indescribable. It is indescribable. But let me go over first a few of the things that people have said about her so you can see how different my take is from most people on what she does. You know, everybody laughs at her, she's whimsical, but they take her pretty unseriously. There's some of the banalities that explain her that I've plucked from the criticism. They sort of place soap opera limits around her work, some of them. We are told, for example, that, quote, she's a seriously whimsical Frenchwoman who acts bizarrely for a living, unquote. That she probes, quote, the trifling neuroses of everyday life, and that she makes the commonplace hyper-legible. But it's only the commonplace. You know, this is very dismissive criticism, really. We're told that hers, these are all critics writing this, hers is the art of the dysfunctional relationship. but it's an art whose natural appeal comes is to the voyeur in all of us, okay? So you get this idea of this kind of lowering, this kind of just common dimension to what she does. On the other hand, some people have given her very elevated praise. Paul Auster calls her the most gifted storyteller. People compare her to Rousseau as this excessive autobiographizing. And she's been compared to Georges Perec. You know Perec's writing, right? At one point, Sophie Kahl devoted whole days to engaging in acts that began only with one particular letter of the alphabet. And then another time she only ate foods of a single color for a whole week, and then she photographed the food series called The Menus. So on the one hand, she's sort of seen as this kind of, I don't know, sort of ha-ha-ha funny woman, sort of a marginal person. And then the other hand, she's this master of fictional self-fashioning, you know, someone like a counterpart to Auster or to Borges. But I would say that the critical judgments that prize Kahl and raise her, you know, honor her this way, are just, in a way, as dismissive as the ones that see her as this kind of gossipy, busybody woman. Because I think they all are limited and framed by the assumption that Kahl is a woman, okay? And that's the beginning and the end of the story. Of course she is a woman. But the assumption, the deeper assumption, is that her artwork, like any woman's work, is merely limited to narcissism and to masquerade, okay? And of course, the reason people think that is it's just entirely her fault. This is a picture of Sophie Kahl as Brigitte Bardot, okay? she's given ample cause for us to see her as just feminine masquerade, okay? Now, you want to see what Sophie Kahl, quote, really looks like in real life. Go to the next slide, please. This is rather a different look. This is her in the film Double Blind, and it's also the way she looks in everyday life. I've had, since I wrote this paper, I've had dinner with her, so, okay. Kahl often seems to be playing at being a woman, the way Sartre's waiter plays at being a waiter, with a vengeance. Her oeuvre is marked by all manner of female complaints. She once took a job as a hotel maid so she could photograph the disordered objects occupants left lying around for her to clean up. The gesture smacks of female ressentiment and the nosiness born of woman's servitude. A menial maidservant taking revenge on her masters by dishing their dirt. Okay, she shows the world, look, this is the slop they did. The critical acclaim for Kahl effectively judges her, at best, as little more than a follower, like Rousseau, like Perec, like Auster, like Borges. But again, the reflexive slotting of Kahl as a woman artist who dutifully emulates her male betters is also her fault. For Kahl most certainly is a follower. Her photographic career began by her trailing random strangers through Paris streets. Another slide. See these images? And dogging a man's heels is central to her best-known work, Suite Vénitienne, as Patricia pointed out, in which she clandestinely followed one fellow she had just met to the canals of Venice. Surely Kahl is playing at something more serious than just playing at being a woman. Indeed, a large portion of her art engages complex layers of social and political issues and challenges the way we unthinkingly make the divide between private and public life. I don't know if you know of this side of her work. She exploits the technology of photography, which is formed by a dialectic of obscurity and visibility, to index unconscious polarities in communal life. The unattainable within the accessible, the intimate within the distant, the memory at the heart of the forgotten. Kahl's work confronts us frankly with our responsibility for the social, a responsibility we are often all too reluctant to take on. In 1994, for example, Kahl went to the site of the breached Berlin Wall to document the still fresh responses people might have to the loss of this concrete representative of political division and or of reunification. Or rather, she went to the site of the gaping hall, the gaping hole the wall's collapse had torn in their symbolic matrix. In her artist statement for Die Entfernung, The Detachment, Kahl writes, quote, I visited places from which symbols of the former East Germany have been effaced. I asked passersby to describe the objects that once filled these empty spaces. I photographed the absence and replaced the missing monuments with their memories. It's very nice. In the detachment, Kahl works her way toward the navel of a collective social dream, Germany's dream of creating its new unity from the fragments of a shattered symbol. Tracing the still marked sense of absence in a people recently sundered from the matrix the wall had provided, Kahl documents the instant before a new, and I'm using the word symbolic, not in the theoretical sense, but in a very concrete way. You know, you're going to get the symbols together and you're going to create a new fiction of social order out of it, has begun to be rewoven. She makes salient the objects this new symbolic will have had to lose in order to implement itself with a fresh, imaginary consistency. Quote, each photograph is accompanied by a book explaining what the monument was and recording the memories of what, accurate or not, was once there. One is the site of where the elite communist soldiers of the new guardhouse once stood guard and is now full of municipal police. The other is where a Communist Party symbol was once on a window. So you get these pictures of absence. In 1999, and this is some of you may have seen this, Kahl constructed the Eruv of Jerusalem in that city's Jewish museum, and she's reconstructed it in other places since, probably New York and San Francisco. Like her Berlin exhibit, this one too touches a sore point, a lesion in the heart of a troubled social order, the open wound that is Jerusalem itself. Hidden beneath the holy city, which is a common sacred symbol that officially divides its people from each other, Kahl unearths a secret sharing. Quote, this installation is inspired by the concept of an eruv, a rabbinic prohibition against carrying objects outside one's home on the Sabbath. Observant Jews erect an eruv, a boundary made of walls, wires, or neutral barriers that establishes a collective property transforming public to private space through which one can move as though within a home. So you don't have to follow certain laws. You can make the public space your home. For this work, composed of 14 sites or stations, Kahl asked 14 inhabitants of Jerusalem, Israelis and Palestinians, each to take her to a public space that they considered private. It had special memories for them. Very nice. She then photographed the sites and transcribed interviews with the subjects who revealed intimate stories about ordinary public places in Jerusalem that became special private spots for them, becoming conceptually transformed from natural sites to symbolic or sacred space. She pointedly ignored Jerusalem's violent political frame and discovered who belongs in the contested city and to whom the city belongs. Quote, some of the stories are politically charged, a wall symbolizing separation between people, a bench on which an admirer kept vigil. Others hold deeply personal significance for the participants, a hotel in the old city named Casanova where two lovers met, a rock where a child used to play in a field that later became the grounds near the president's residence. Kahl redefines, in a way, what Jerusalem's sacred sites really are. The common space is where, and only where, the dreams of the one do not interfere with and displace those of the other. Okay, you see the point. It says, we all have dreams, we all have desires, and the idea is that the true symbolic has to make room for desire. Okay, with the Eruv, we begin to see intimations of Kahl's more general point. The piece is obviously about the flawed way we grasp Jerusalem, but it is also about the crucial defect inherent in any cultural symbol. There's always a defect in the symbol, okay? The symbolic has a defect. It has a flaw. It can't cover everything it wants to cover. There's always a contradiction. There's always a hole in the middle of it. The fact is that it can never, no symbol can ever fully represent the human links that animate it, okay? Kahl's work makes strikingly clear the multiplicity of unacknowledged desires in Jerusalem, but it also demonstrates that they can coexist only where there is a truly symbolic space. Okay, you can't, you know, one will always displace, erase, efface, repress the other. By the symbolic, Lacan meant a credible fiction that sustains our existence in common. It's fiction, but it's not fiction to the extent that we believe in it, Okay, we believe that we need to have common ground. We believe that we need to coexist. Otherwise, we're in the world of paranoia. We're in the world of, somebody here was earlier talking about the war of all against all, right? And I would say that Call's work can be seen as an unflinching documentation executed in a charming, quirky, and unexpected way of the blindnesses of the official symbolic, the one that has too long been shaped by an imaginary phallic logic that has grown stale and blind to beauty. Note that Call once interviewed blind people about what they considered beautiful. She has a whole installation of pictures of blind people and them saying, I think that I've heard descriptions that the sea reflects the sky in itself and the mountains, and that I would love to be able to experience that. So it's just, like Lacan, however, you know, Patricia talked about the horror and the tragedy, and that's true, but remember that what Lacan says in his chapter on Antigone, that beauty makes a barrier to that horror. Like Lacan, however, Call finds the symbolic essential to human coexistence, even if for her it can no longer be cast in the old phallic mold. She may be interested in seeing it recognize the feminine, but she doesn't do it in this kind of, women's studies way. Rather, Call addresses a stern demand to the symbolic. It must accommodate the indefinable, incompatible desire of the other without brutally overexposing it the way the perverse would demand. You know, I know what you want, and you got to, you know what I want, and everybody knows, and there's no desire left. It's all jouissance all the time. Public space, as a representative of the symbolic, must be made to confess how much it is populated with and haunted by desires it embraces yet fails to symbolize. And who can do that except for art? What can do that except for art to remind us, as like her photographs of the Berlin Wall that isn't there anymore, to remind us of what isn't there anymore. How much the symbolic is penetrated by internal rifts and extimate commands that reveal their presence only through glaring omissions and social parapraxies. So we were downtown yesterday looking at the plan for the city, and it was all, you know, oh, we're going to do this, and we're going to bring people and revitalize it. And then somebody mentioned that North Philadelphia is now a 10% occupancy rate in this housing. And you think, how can they be making a plan when they don't take that into account? What's going on here? You know, I'm not saying that there's any ill will or bad faith on the part of the people. It's just an omission. How then do we reconcile Call's in-your-face femininity with her sustained address to the great political hotspots of our time? How do we reconcile her following men with her challenge to their one-sided ownership of public space? Unlike classical feminists, Call stubbornly refuses to give up on the symbolic. She's not like Kristeva. She shows no desire to reconcile women reluctantly to the established phallic ordering of human things, nor does she try to reform the principles of organization like Gary Garai. What she does do, despite being a woman, is simply refuse to give up on the symbolic. She insists on trying to make it work. She insists that the symbolic order do the job it's supposed to do. And that is the most radical and frightening thing someone can do, is to tell an organization or institution it has to actually live up to its, what it's supposed to be doing. And the job it's supposed to do is to embrace and sustain the most contradictory dreams and desires. The fact that it is a woman who issues this demand today when everyone else is receding from that seems to me to be very telling. Okay. I see Call as aiming at nothing less than a refunctioning of the symbolic, ridding it of its outdated, overly phallic style. Call's gamble is this, that art, which has the power to index the subtle penetration of public style, public representations by desire, can do so now only if it retailers the symbolic in a style as far from the typically masculine, logico-phallic, and falsely oppositional as possible. When the towers came down, they interviewed, the Times, I think, interviewed 10 or so architects. You know, what should we do? And 9 of the 10 said, oh, rebuild them bigger and higher than ever. And the man-woman team of Diller and Scofidio said, no, leave it so that we would you know, remember it all the more by its absence. Certain contrivances will be required, she finds, to attempt this traverse of the divide between the intimate and extimate, the one and the other, the male and the female, the Arab and the Jew. In Call's hands, such devices are predictably feminine, but not in an easily recognizable or standard sense, like Call herself. For example, her proposition of following plays on the world's most traditional placement for woman, behind a man, right? Follow in the man's footsteps. Unlike Duras Lalvi Stein, who stalks and then wins her best friend's new lover, Call won't try shock tactics to overturn this positioning. Instead, she produces an unexpected twist simply by refusing the automatic devaluation that following in a man's footsteps or man-chasing connotes. Call thus makes a singular place for herself out of the quintessence of female inferiority. You know, this idea of you're humbly following behind a man. Well, she does that humbly. She doesn't even know who the man is. She follows him. And yet somehow she makes, it's like, you know, what is the word when you have something really bad and then you make something good? You know, it's Brecht and I think it's Brecht or Benjamin. Someone said, don't ever start, you know, with the good old things. Start with the bad new ones and see what you can make of them. You know, like Benjamin Brecht looking at the terrible daily newspapers and trying to see the art potential in them. Sex like politics. Oh, okay. And she conjures it there in the very spot where woman is never really supposed to be, in the public sphere and out on the streets. Sex like politics thus proves pivotal or fatal to Call's enterprise. Her art focuses on the no man's land or DMZ of the terrain between the sexes, perhaps because it is the only place in our collective experience where feminine specificity is even faintly legible. Now, it's either, you know, an opposition male-female or masculine-feminine, and you concentrate on the masculine and the feminine is what isn't masculine, okay? And, of course, Lacan had a much better way of dealing with that in terms of the all and the not all. But we won't get into that now. Her stubborn resistance to how this terrain is usually mapped out and negotiated also implicitly critiques Freud's and Lacan's first chartings of sexuation. For example, Call plays at being a proper hysteric and double game, where she flirts, a la Lacanian theory, with taking on a perverse master. For double game, Call, and Patricia talked about this already, had asked novelist Paul Auster to make her do his bidding for one whole year. She would follow to the letter his written instructions, which included such things as making her stay a whole day in a public phone booth, waiting for his call. I will do whatever you tell me, she says, for up to 1 year. Nothing is out of bounds. The most important thing is for me to obey you. Note, however, the singularity of Call's hysterical demand to her chosen sadistic master. Auster must provide, and Patricia mentioned this already, personal instructions for Sophie Call on how to improve life in New York City. Now, that's a pretty big leap from this interpersonal, intersexual relation to the public domain. Double game's implied claim that private sexual arrangements can amend public life strains credulity, to be sure. But there it is. It's Call's way of using soccer masoch to get beyond it. Interestingly, while Auster's role-playing yielded his 1992 novel Leviathan, in which Call appears as his neurotic artist lover, Maria Turner, right, I think it was, Call artistically mastered her experience with him quite differently. I don't know how many of you know this film. She embarked on a new collaboration and a new variation on Lacan's no sexual relation with playwright Greg Shepard. Together, they made the film Double Blind, which has another title, which I'll tell you in a minute, which documents the pair's cross-country drive in an old Cadillac convertible. The formulaic, hysteric master couple that Call played out with Auster in Double Game gets completely inverted in Double Blind, in which there is no question of official mastery and servitude. Indeed, Call and Shepard highlight a formal equality between them. She has money, but he has a car, and they share everything supposedly equally along the way. The film sees them motoring from New York to California and marrying each other, by the way, in a drive-through wedding chapel in Las Vegas. this is the first reason I went to Colorado, because I was writing about Las Vegas, and somebody said, oh, you have to go see Double Blind. Double Blind opens with Sophie at Seaside. She has come to New York to work with Shepherd, and she learns of writer Hervé Guibert's death from AIDS. When she learns that she goes, it opens with her going to the seaside to scatter flowers in his memory. And then she leaves Guibert a message on his answering machine, even though he's dead, to tell him what she's done. So it's very moving. And then she takes off on the cross-country drive. Beforehand, she and Greg have agreed to film each other during the trip and to edit it only later with voiceovers that they add in. Despite their formal equality, their respective voiceover commentaries express how much each feels oppressed by the other. Okay. Sophie's voiceovers mock Greg's very minimal male mechanical expertise with his ever-failing car. Using appropriately Freudian commentary, she says, he looks under the car's bonnet like a man fascinated with his wife giving birth. Greg's, and you can see this giant Cadillac with its hood open and his head under there. It's pretty good. Greg's voiceovers have him responding to Sophie's chit-chat with hostility and oppositionality. His malaise in her presence is palpable. It's almost physical discomfort. He's constantly irritated at her parsimony with him, and he's very angry at the spot she's put him in. She has gotten him, after all, stuck in backwoods America. You know, they go through the South and the Southwest and Texas and everywhere. You know, he's this quintessential sort of New York, you know, very New York, nothing beyond New York, okay? They just illustrate her petty cruelty, right, making him go there. Playing the girl, Sophie tells Greg she wants to be desired. She wants someone to ask her to marry her. She reveals that when she was younger, her father tricked her into being psychoanalyzed. He told her that she had bad breath and that she had to see a doctor, and it turned out he was an analyst. And I don't know if this story is true or not. In the movie, I think she says it when she's a young girl, and in another installation, she was in her 30s already. But, you know, anyway. Shepherd responds to her girl talk with noncommittal, stereotypical male grunts. Her chatter strains to introduce something besides the monster car to act as a metaphoric transport over their deep sexual divide. Remember metaphor, it's the transport across. But her verbal efforts only harden the pair's absence of sexual relation. The broken-down Cadillac symbolizes the pair's lack of harmony, their missing romantic involvement, and their sexual impasse, about which only Call ventures to remark. Each evening, to economize, she and Shepherd share the same motel room, and each morning she photographs the bed where the two people have slept, together but not together, and she says, no sex last night. And this goes on like 15 times in the movie. You see a still of the bed, and it's all rumpled up. You know, two people have obviously slept in it, but it's no sex last night. Pretty soon it becomes no. So the movie is also known as No Sex Last Night. Although Call's touch is light, the swath she's cutting is very deep. Her investigations of the no sexual relation are systematic and patiently pursued. She was only 27 when she did Suite Venetienne, for example. That's pretty young. There is no doubt that she makes it difficult to get past the surface caprice and simple charm in her work to reach what is in fact her stubbornly complex effort to link sex to social life. In both of her sexual collaborations, Double Game, Double Blind, Call reworks gender power relations, the making and breaking of sex stereotypes, the conventional relation of public to private, interior to exterior, etc. But she does so with much greater dimensionality than the pieties of women's studies and watered-down Lacanian, Freudian verities about gender and sexuality furnish. For example, while it looks like Double Blind, No Sex Last Night, simply describes the predictable arc of today's male-female relationships, the sexual relation that does not exist between Call and Shepherd, as between Call and Auster, Call and Henri B. and Sweet Venetienne, nevertheless insists. From its vantage or vanishing point, Call obliges us to exert ourselves to catch the glimpse it provides of otherwise unthinkable social and even political outcomes. Outcomes centered not on sex's most convenient and convergent image, the visible phallus, the image, and I'm talking about the imaginary phallus here, right? But precisely on the unfathomability of sexual difference, which is the true and real work of the symbolic phallus, is to create a difference that only desire can overcome, okay? And it's intangible, it's unfathomable, it isn't, you know, in our country we're very pragmatic, very down to earth, very practical. We want to see yes and no, this and that. In a recent essay I was writing about, you know, Judith Butler saying, well, you know, just taking the universal down, you know, there's no such thing as the universal after all, da-da-da, everything's got to be very suspicious of the universal. And I kept thinking, there is a universal, though. It doesn't have to be done in this totalizing Hegelian way. And I thought, what about Rosa Parks? Rosa Parks, when she just sat there and didn't move when they told her to get to the back of the bus, what was she doing but saying the universal no? And what was she saying? No one should be treated like this. And that's universal. It's kind of a negative, feminine universal. Not everyone is being treated like this, and yet no one should be treated like this. This is the kind of intangible that the symbolic, the no, the, you know, the paternal function can give you that everyone's forgetting. She didn't sit there and say, you can't make me move because just because I'm a woman and under, you know, whatever all the checklists we have in our politically correct world. It had nothing, you know, all of that was nothing in the face of no one should have to be treated this way. Not a single person on earth should have to be treated this way. The not all is very nice there. Anyway, so let's see, back to where I broke away from my paper. I would say that, suggest that Call's work also inaugurates a reorientation of the objects and aims of aesthetics and ethics on the basis of femininity. Now, I have a long piece on the Beyond the Pleasure Principle, but I think we can skip that for the moment. And let's look at the, get to this part where I speak about her art, in particular, the photography. And I have a quote from Gilles Deleuze in Cinema 2. Film became a medium of pure optics, where not only the viewer but the protagonist must see and hear the things and the people in order for an action or a passion to be born, erupting in a pre-existing life. Okay, so there's this eruption. Gilles Deleuze had his way of critiquing radically what once passed for the symbolic order and was now, in his eyes, clearly on the verge of collapse. He chose a historical moment of catastrophe, the years preceding, during, and following World War II. For Deleuze, the war and its accompanying events were a trauma that sundered Europe from its immediate and long-term values and shattered its history. From this moment, there emerged a radical repositioning of time, space, and subjectivity, according to Deleuze. And Deleuze, of course, everyone sees him, oh, the great opponent of Lacan. Not at all. He was very influenced by Lacan and very respectful of Lacan. He didn't like French psychiatry, but he did very much honor Lacan, and he defended him when Lacan was being kicked out of the École Normale. Not only Europe's, but everyone's sense of place underwent a rupture, which forced scenes of action and movement out of their classic locations in spaces, into spaces whose coordinates were as yet unmapped. For Deleuze, it was film that was best able to project the large-scale consequences to the classic symbolic collapse. And I'm talking about the imaginary symbolic, not the true function of the symbolic, but this image we had of how order worked and how society should be organized and very nicely put together. According to Deleuze, representation and narrative in post-war cinema could no longer be about actions and outcomes, since the way from one point to the next was simply unknowable. In the films of Roberto Rossellini's Germany Year Zero and Stromboli, which, if you recall, have you ever seen them? Germany Year Zero, Stromboli, anybody? They're so rarely shown in the United States. It's amazing, but they're fantastic films. They vividly depict an urgent disorientation. Anyone who ventures into the streets that Rossellini filmed would be forced to make up their itinerary, and few would dare. Germany Year Zero is about a German a little German boy after the war in Berlin, and the city is totally bombed out. And the father is sick. The brother is in hiding because he didn't go to the war. The father was anti-Hitler. The little boy is completely lost. And but he's responsible for feeding the family. He goes out and he has to find little scraps and barter and bargain. And as he does so, he finds from an old teacher, he finds an old phonograph record of Hitler's speeches. And on the basis of this voice, this disembodied voice, this true embodiment of this sadistic, obscene superego, he decides that it's his duty to kill his weakling father who had resisted Hitler. And I mean, it's a tragic movie, and yet, I mean, it really, it should be seen. I don't know, have you ever seen it? It's just an incredible movie. Anyway, Stromboli similarly is very investigative of this moment. Into the breach, woman. Unlikely as it is, she is what will come as a response to a world suddenly forced to make room without knowing how, why, or precisely what for. This is no accident. In the public street, woman was always fully vulnerable, morally and physically, open to any passerby, admiring poets like Dante, Petrarch, and Baudelaire, calculating seducers like Kierkegaard, and any potential assailant. On tradition streets, women enjoyed only a checked public being at best. Thus, even the darkest alleys of Deleuze Rossellini were already hardly foreign to her. Into this breach too, Sophie Call, the woman who gets affirmatively lost in a unique civic space filled with sunlit plazas and darkened byways, the space of an enigmatic city called Venice. Let us follow Call to Venice. Let us follow her drive to penetrate public space with private passions and counter phallic modes of symbolization with styles as far from masculine obscurity and perverse hyperlegibility as possible. To follow her is to follow woman into the beyond of the pleasure principle. And then you get, this is Venice, and then there's one more. But for months, I followed strangers in the street for the pleasure of following them, not because they particularly interested me. I photographed them without their knowledge, took note of their movements, then finally lost sight of them and forgot them. At the end of January 1980, on the streets of Paris, I followed a man whom I lost sight of for a few minutes later in the crowd. That very evening, quite by chance, he was introduced to me at an opening. During the course of our conversation, he told me he was planning an imminent trip to Venice. A chance encounter. Call uses it to make a sudden decision. She will continue filming this particular man without his knowledge, following him surreptitiously to Venice. Ironically, Call actually arrives at Venice before he does, so in effect, he follows her. Her father sees her off at the station. But because she has now spoken with Henri B., his name is Henry B., face-to-face, Call must take precautions. Quote, in my suitcase, a makeup kit so I can disguise myself, a blonde bobbed wig, hats, veils, gloves, sunglasses, a Leica, that's a camera, and a Squintar, a lens attachment, equipped with a set of mirrors so you can take photographs without aiming at the subject. It goes around the corner. Tomorrow I will see Venice for the first time. From their brief conversation, Sophie has learnt the man's name, that he too is a photographer. None of this seems to make him a special objective for her any more special than the anonymous Parisians she films on the sly in Paris. The mystery of why him only deepens once we notice that she takes pain never to discover purposely or by chance anything about this man that does not specifically appear in public. She doesn't want to know anything about his private life or his anything. She wants to know his social persona, basically. She doesn't pursue any intimate knowledge. She certainly doesn't want to catch him in the act of doing anything obscene, embarrassing, or silly. Her epistemophilia has nothing to do with revelation, confession, ego, or narcissistic self-images. She mainly photographs legs and feet, after all. That's what she takes. A lot of the pictures are of just the feet, somebody's foot on a bar stool in a cafe. In the end, again, ironically, it is she who is unmasked by him, too. At the end, he sees through her masquerade. Call's choice posits a strangely impersonal desire to know, a desire of which he and she alike slowly become the objectives that I anticipate. Despite her cool moves, how much time do I have? It's getting a little long, but it won't be too much longer. She makes a little journal with entries in it, and the entries are of two kinds. One are in regular type, and the others are in italics. And my hypothesis is, or my thesis is, that the italics have to do with her subjective state, and the others are with her objective situation. There's nothing at risk for Call in her odd pursuit of Henry B. No personal relationship, no legal liability. But her italic asides portray her act as absolutely fraught with panic, anxiety, and fear. A dread is taking hold of me. He recognizes me. He's following me. He knows. What if he should see me? Fear seizes me again at the specific designation of Henri B's habits. I'm afraid of meeting up with him. I've got to get hold of myself. I lean against a column and close. You have these constant emotional, like something really horrendous is going to take place. It's understandable that Call would not want him to see her. It would disrupt her project. He's under her surveillance, yet it is she, the private eye with a panoptic surveillance of his every movement, who is terrified. But what does she fear would be revealed about him if she got too close or watched him too intimately? Oddly enough, it seems to be the specific description of Henri B's habits that provokes her maximum anxiety. Still, Sophie's fear seems located neither in the watcher nor in the watched, but in a more generalized sense of heightened vulnerability that comes with the visibility of being in the streets, being in the public sphere, being out in the city. Strangely, Call's rule of not looking for Henri B's truth reads almost as a protective gesture. From what? I would say that it is from the gaze, this gaze that has been unleashed, as Deleuze, in a way, is trying to say, this gaze that is not centered in the visual, the ocular, the organized, phallically, nicely organized look, but the gaze. Once the symbolic fiction that its order accommodates the other desire fades or recedes, nothing, or I would say the thing, looms with its implacable, impersonal, all-seeing, yet blind gaze. Both Sophie and Henri B are equally naked before it. Her following him seems almost a way to cover for him and to make common cause with him against the thing. She will accompany this man step by step and walk the same streets with him, even though he cannot yet appreciate her gesture. For if he sees her through the usual symbolic grid, phallic symbolic grid, he will, without thinking, simply put her in her place. He will offhandedly dismiss her or relegate her to a lower moral, social, and artistic status. Well, she's just another, she's a girl photographer, right? I'm the man who's going, hmm. As a man, he must reflexively posit himself as the only one of the two who properly belongs in the street. The real reason Sophie doesn't want Henri B to see her is that just yet, he could not really see her at all. Mm-hmm. While this makes the stakes of her non-relation to Henri B seem absurdly high, even on a social level, Call's strange gesture has a metaphoric ring. Too close, she will never learn the range and scope of the legitimate streetwalker that he is and that she aspires to become. Struck blind to her in advance, he would be incapable of seeing her the way she strives to be seen, as someone who is legitimately there in the streets with him. Wandering over the routes, she says, that we took together these last 2 days, Henri B and I. He doesn't even know he's with her, but he's with her. Yeah. Call is perfectly delighted, on the other hand, to be seen by all the other men she encounters in Venice. She positively encourages their libidinal attentions, and she relishes her ironic feminine masquerade as a sex object for them. She tells us that she loves being told, for the first time in my life, that I'm a beautiful blonde. The Bordeaux wit. A perfect damsel in distress, she makes herself dependent on the gallant kindness of all the strangers. Everyone, she gets everybody involved. She tells everybody these funny, phony cover stories. She tells her landlord, for example, I'm looking for a man. I want to know what he's doing in Venice, and I don't want him to know I'm in the city. His name is Henri B., and he's staying at the Casa de Stefani. Could you help me? Her landlord quickly discovers that Henry B. is now in Venice along with his wife and that he's there to photograph the pensione he's staying in. The longer Call follows Henry B. and his wife, the more assistance she requires. One man, who had earlier given her the eye in a cafe, finds her crouched and shivering in the dark of an alley waiting for Henry B. and his wife to emerge from an antique dealer. 8:10 p.m. The man who stared at me for a long time leaves La Colomba. He stops and speaks to me. He's surprised to find me in the same spot in this cold. He wants to know if he can be of some help. I tell him I'm in love with a man. Italics, only love seems admissible. And this man has been in Luigi's antique shop since 6:15 in the company of a woman. And she does perfectly well, says his wife. I asked him to go join them alone and tell me what he's seen when he comes back. He agrees to do it. Call deceives this helpful man, but is what she says really a lie? Isn't there some truth to Sophie's fiction of being, quote, in love with a man? What other way is there of describing the reason behind her artistic sleuthing, her shadowing and purloining of Henry B.'s image? Now, she's not, you know, everybody says, ah, she's the stalker or she's this obsessional or something, a voyeur. I would say, rather, that as Call mobilizes the eyes and ears of others in her quest to see Henri B., always missing him, just glimpsing him, staying out of view, it is this kindness of strangers that escalates her quest into the very paradigm of a love story. The strangers who support her do so readily because hers seems simply to be the exceptional absorption, the only one that's excusable, that of the lover. Only love seems admissible. Only a lover's discourse, indeed, could justify her behavior. None of Lacan's other discourses pertain, for she simply isn't covered by those forms of the social tie, mastery, hysteria, perversion, that woman and her excess are classically fitted into. Love alone explains Sophie's conduct. And she says, it's a totally impersonal love. I think about that phrase by Proust, to think that I've wasted years of my life, that I wanted to die, and that I had my greatest love for a woman whom I did not care for and who was not my type. And these are all italics. I must not forget that I don't have any amorous feelings toward Henry B. The impatience with which I await his arrival, the fear of that encounter, these symptoms really aren't part of me. Why remind herself? Because even though she is following a man to whom she has no sentimental attachment, Call finds herself enmeshed in the forms of a Stendhalian passion. And isn't Henri B., after all, Henri Bell? I mean, Stendhal's name was Henri Bell. Slowly, Call comes to occupy the well-known role of the obsessive lover, bathing in love's atmosphere of dread mixed with elation and hope, and so on. But let me tell you, let me just end by going to the city. I know it's been a long night for you and everybody's hot. Something about this city makes Call's move a more dangerous game than the one she'd been playing in Paris. Even though its oldest symbols of power are regularly flooded out, you know, in Venice, the church, the Piazza San Marco, and all these things, they're always getting, you know, in danger of sinking completely. And its autocratic governance with its blind injustice have long since vanished. We could try to interpret her desire to get lost here. That's what she says, I want to get lost in this city. We can interpret it psychoanalytically as her submitting herself to the city as the subject acquiesces to castration by language and civilization. Yet Venice's stark uniqueness as a city, this particular city, belies any potential castration allegory. Venice has far more often represented fatal deviant love than Christian submissiveness. She says, I refuse to think about my being in this place. I must not think about it. I must stop pondering possible outcomes, wondering where the story is leading me. I will follow it to the end. Venice also provides a serious material obstacle to defining Call submission along classic symbolic lines. With its watery ways, Venice is the city that most voids standard patriarchal images for channeling desire. Lacan's La Grande Route être père, you know, the superhighway being a father. If Call has elected to find herself and the disappeared man in the street in this particular city, it is at least in part because there are no literal streets in Venice. Certainly not in the conventional urban Parisian sense of grand boulevard that whisk you where you want to go and guide the ever-accelerating pace of urban life. Here, you are reduced to the slower paces of walking and water transport. Here you forego the torque and acceleration of vehicular land traffic, and you dispense with motorized wheeled high-velocity conveyances. Venice deprives you of the illusion that you have drive under control. The critical illusion of urban civilization, sustained by an array of concrete metaphors. You know, the metaphor is the Greek word for bus, right? Autobus, as they show on. In Venice, as man and others knew, you only get carried away. Finally, Venetian canals could never properly represent the traffic controlling of desire and the patriarchal shaping of male-female positions the way urban arteries do. Venice constitutes a new medium for Call's experiment of culturing sexual difference in a non-obvious way. In the end, for Call, Venice is what allows something to emerge specifically and to emerge from her. This is my dream, not his. There is such a gap between his thoughts and mine. I'm the only one dreaming. Henry B.'s feelings do not belong in my story. How will she make this story of hers, make this into a story of hers, is not clearly laid out. The customary traffic signs are missing. You know, it's hard to follow the story knowing, you know, we know narrative. We've known it, you know, since Oedipus, right? She doesn't have those, even those nice metonymic rails to drive desire along. But what she does have is something different, is that she, in Venice, Venice itself seems to shake the standard normal controls in charge of Sophie's drives, as though some accidental acceleration of death drive has taken shape for her in the sunny plaza of this liquid city that once marked the very edge of Western civilization. Drive surges forth visibly as Sophie walks behind Henri B. And there's this one moment, she's walking behind him at 4 p.m. I settle in on my bench at the Piazza San Marco. This is regular type, okay? Venice is preparing for the carnival. Children are already in costume. I watch at length a little boy with a feathered headdress, like an Indian, American Indian, Native American, who's tirelessly chasing pigeons with a knife. Italics. I would like to see him kill one. It's italics, of course. So, you know, okay, water is the medium of reflection, transparency, solubility, and photography. Watery Venice brings out the inward, passional, thoughtful, rational, painful, and joyful Sophie Call to contrast with the bored, whimsical, unserious woman with a camera of her Parisian flirtation with the man of the crowd. Venice's waterways mark the limit and margins of Sophie's desire. They seem to bring out rather than diminish her jouissance. What Call and Venice sees in herself and helps us to see another is that no civilization can ever fully contain or channel the drive that fuels desire. Hence Sophie's fear, hence her recourse to love. It's just the only alternative. Call must therefore forge a new pathway for an excess in her. No phallic mask and no figures of speech can or will turn Sophie's psychical energy to domesticated desire. But why is it then that even without these classic gadgets for dissipating jouissance, her jouissance is not finally out of control? She works at rerouting her feminine excess to the surface, and she desperately wants to remark it with the constraints of symbolic law. Hence her exceptional need for a symbolic that loses its patriarchal, Aristotelian, and phallocentric bias. What makes Call's effort so important is that she's also doing exactly the same thing for Henry B. Men, too, need such a discursive change. Being a true mystery to her, Henry B. can all the more easily stand in for man in general. After all, Call has insisted on tracking him only insofar as he is unknowable, unidentifiable as a specific man. So what has she been on the trail of is rather, is what she's been on the trail of is rather that public man who is said to have recently disappeared, his various metaphoric masks having vanished one by one. By addressing her quest to a strictly public self of Henri B., Call challenges the belief that such a man has actually vanished from our future and hers. Call's work assures us that he has never existed, but that he also insists, and that he nevertheless can come once more. So I would say that Sweet Venetienne is a gauntlet thrown down to men who are now in full retreat from the public sphere. Although they would surely deny it, their withdrawal parallels their equal lapse in private relations. No sex last night. Okay, I'll end it there. There's more, but I'll end it there. And it's a lot that I threw it down. I'm sorry. I've got that feminine excess. I can't help it. I have to do it all. Yes?
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the death drive in that square in Venice.
Yeah.
which I know would be a lot to get into, but I was sort of curious.
Well, there was a lot more, and I actually skimmed through it because I knew you were getting late and tired. But it seems to me that one of the ways we allow ourselves to sort of, go stale, but also to fail to realize that the symbolic is just not there. You have to keep remaking the social contract over and over and over again. It isn't something that it's in the Constitution or something, and it's there, and you just leave it. You have to realize the drive is always there. And I have a much longer section on the pleasure principle and Lacan's notion of transgression. He says, you never discover desire except by transgressing a certain limit. So it's very important for her to make this transgression, to realize that she does have death drive, and at the same time responds to it. It's the model of the response to the drive, which we have always taken to be the way to, deal with it is to, sort of in classical Freudian terms, is to the Oedipal model. You get over the Oedipal complex, you face the superego, then you face that you've got something, and you deal with it. For women, how has that worked? On the one hand, she seems to be almost the thing herself. How is she supposed to say, no, there's only a portion of me as a subject that is not subject to the signifier, that isn't subject to being castrated, right? But how, we don't have a good model for that. And to me, I think her art is saying, look, here's one way I can deal with this. I've got Venice, I've got this city that isn't really a city, that's got these watery margins around it. It isn't civilization as such. And here is where death drive can come forth and make its presence felt, and now here's how I'm going to respond to it. And I'm going to respond to it with this protective gesture toward the man. I'm going to respond to it with the discourse of love rather than any of the other discourses. And that's the way it works. Does that help? Mm-hmm. Yes, Patricia.
When you were mentioning that she was following the street walker and hoping to become...
Right. A legitimate street walker, yes.
A legitimate street walker. It could even stop by hearing that her last name, Cal, in Spanish would be street.
That's right. And in Venice also, in all, unique in Italy, Cal is the word for street.
Uh-huh.
So she knew what she was doing, yes.
Okay,
so they use the word call, or I don't know how they pronounce it in that particular dialect of Italian, but they don't use strada. They don't use strada or via. They use calle or call, whatever it is. Yeah, it's very interesting.
And then the name of the father.
Yes, exactly. It's so perfect. Yes, she's so brilliant.
I'm going for the name.
Yes.
How has she navigated away from the highway of the name of the father? I was thinking you seem to suggest a fifth discourse. If we have the grade of the fourth discourse is presented by Lacan, the fifth discourse of the labor.
Yes.
And you said you were also working on the city and the political aspect of hysteria. And you're proposing a different form of politics or policy.
Yes, I am. I've done a lot of work on it. I haven't put it all together in the book, but I've done work on Las Vegas. I've done work on Chicago.
What is the connection between the discourse of the labor and another? This is a failing aspect of the discourse of hysteria, where he stays with challenge the master, this form of
and then just, look for a new master, exactly, yes.
Would the labor have a different...
I would tend to think so. I come from this long line of working on the lovers' discourses, Rousseau on down, and Stendhal. That's why I was interested in her at first. I said, my goodness, this Henri B. has got, and Stendhal, said that Italy was the last place in Europe where passionate love could still survive. You know, all these, I'm sure that's feeding into her work too. And in the Hysterics Guide, I do try to talk about that quite a bit, where Stendhal takes on the feminine perspective, and you know, it's to be worked out. I think she's just the beginning, mm-hmm. and certainly the feminine lover. You know, we've had the Don Juans, we've had you know the Werthers, we've had all of these you know Semple and Rousseau, but I would say the line is more Stendhal and even Barthes. You know, Barthes' Lover's Discourse,
yeah.
It's very interesting as a move. And so, but you know, the thing that is so striking in this 27-year-old woman is that she wanted, in a way, to do it all, to link this intimate discursive tie to the other two much bigger issues. And of course, I've been pushing it even more in that direction, trying to do that. So. The political aspect is going to be very interesting because I've written a series of essays, one called Urban Perversions, which appeared in Third Text last year. I wrote the Las Vegas Sun in Performance Research. What else have I written? Oh, a thing called The Non-Accidental Tourist. It was a review for Design Book Review of urban theorists who believe that cities should be for people to not meet. to make people, to allow people to go through cities and come to cities, go to work in them, even live in them, in these, what they actually call bubbles, so that they slide past each other without any abrasiveness. This is their theory of how to avoid conflict. And it's a totally perverse structure because the symbolic means that there's conflict and contradiction that you've had to overcome, that there's something that you have to throw across the divide between the one and the other. And this way of saying, oh, no, you just rub past each other and you never have any friction, it's not possible. And yet it is shaping cities today. And I call it the fetishization of the city, which you see all around you. Oh, everything is no longer what it was. It's sort of this mocked-up version of itself. You know, so this is where my thought is going. And the book is almost done. I'm getting there. Any other questions? Too much for everybody? It's feminine excess, you know, I just can't deal with it. The book that I'm doing, yes, Las Vegas, Chicago, the Venice here, I don't know, help me, Dean, I can't read San Francisco. I haven't done Los Angeles. Mike Davis did a job on it, but Los Angeles is extremely varied as a city, and it's it has a particular and peculiar social base, which is very, you know, it partakes of segregation and something of the South that he's located in. I love Los Angeles in some ways, but not in the idea of Los Angeles. There's something amiss that no one's facing there. I mean, Mike Davis is screaming and yelling, but I don't know if he nails it completely. It's the experience. It's what, you know, I go back to the old, in my book, The Hysterics Guide, I also go back to the old ideology. Before Marx, the German ideology, there was a French ideology, you know? Do you know this? Do you remember Destut de Tracy, anybody? And right in the era of Napoleon, the Revolution, Destut de Tracy wrote a book called Ideologie proprement dite, ideology properly so called. And it claimed that the form of governance of a people had to do with the structure of amorous and other relationships between them. And Stendhal picked up on this in his book called Love, in which he tries to make, it's really a very funny book, a relationship between, you know, the monarchy and what love is like under monarchy, what love is like under democracy, what love is like in the United States, none at all, because it's a business culture. No. He says, put a young woman and a young man together in a room for however long you like, but as long as there's a question of money between them, well, no sex left night. and then he talks about revolution as the only moment in which the sexes ever have equality and can really love each other. I mean, it's a really interesting itinerary. And Stendhal was an aficionado of Destut de Tracy. So I, you know, even though we're all Marxists and, you know, post-Marxists and everything else, it seemed to me that Stendhal and his use of, de Trossi hated Stendhal anyway, but Stendhal's picking up on that for the sexual relation and for the feminine seemed to me so astute and still so appropriate, because after all, if you're dealing with the great big issues, you know, the economic history, you know, how much have women had been able to participate in that? You know, you all think, oh, yeah, we're all equal and everything, but it isn't that long ago. You know, I was the first woman I ever knew who became a professor. I mean, I had a woman professor, right? And there was a young other person at Cornell who was a woman who was teaching there, and I mentioned to my woman professor, who I didn't even notice was a woman, by the way, that I was a next-door neighbor to this other person. And she said, oh, yes, she's the other one. And I kept, it took me a week to say, well, the other one what? The other one what? Oh, the other woman. There's no other. I never had a woman, you know, except for this one professor. So, you know, you think that times are the way they have always been, but they're not. And it's very, it's, you know, so the Stendhal and the lover and all this, this seems like an interesting line to me. So that's how I've been doing it. I would like to see City Shape more feminine than phallic. And I think it's probably time, given what just happened. So, any other questions? No other questions? Well, it's hot, and I think we can all go out and get a cool breeze.